I'm Terry Thornton. I'm curator of education, and this is a new program, Sundays with Andy. So glad you could make it today. It's been a great success. We are drawing on the incredible talent from our artist community, from the DFW Metroplex, to do a tour every Sunday through the run of the Andy Warhol Last Decade exhibition. We've done three so far. This is our fourth, and they've been really successful. People have responded very well, so we're obviously on to something. I encourage you to get online and look at the lineup. There are still many to come. I guess 10 more, 14 weeks. So encourage you to do that. Today, we are so fortunate to have with us Linda Blackburn. Linda is an artist who lives and has lived and worked for quite a while in Fort Worth. She lives with her husband, Ed Blackburn, who's also an artist and sometimes her collaborator. They work independently as well as collaborate together on some works. And Ed actually is one of the artists for this Sundays with Andy as well. So I encourage you to come back. If you want to do a comparison of spouses, you can come back and listen to Ed as well. Linda is a painter, filmmaker, video artist. She really just, I think, pretty much anything, printmaker. I think whatever medium it takes to fulfill her idea, she finds a way to do it and does it well. Linda has a BFA from University of Texas and an MA from UC Berkeley. She actually, in the 1970s, was a curator for the Modern Art Museum of Fort Worth. She worked with artists such as Red Grooms and Robert Rauschenberg at that time, so she knows a little bit about this museum, you might say. She's also faithfully worked for us as an artist throughout the years, teaching classes as well. She has received an NEA, a National Endowment for the Arts in Painting, as well as a Mid-America NEA. She has worked with her husband, collaborated with her husband on a film titled The Lonesome Utrillo. Did I say that correctly? The Lonesome Utrillo, it's a 30-minute mystery film with a lot of artists from this area that I also collaborated with them, worked with them on that, and it was screened here in 2007. And she has so much more to mention, but I'm going to mention some things that you can actually find in this community. Some of her local public art projects would include at DFW, I assume it's the International Gates, she has stained glass window in the chapel there. That's part of a very impressive collection that American Airlines has. She also did the wall at I-30 in Henderson. You can see that if you're headed south on Henderson. You can look for Linda's contribution to those wall pieces. And then she and Ed worked on, have a mural at 8-0, which is downtown, called Eddie Leon. And that, some of you may remember, actually, that there was an exhibition, The Adventures of Eddie Leon, that was in the Modern's downtown space when we had a gallery down there in 1998. A variation on that exhibition was at the University of Nevada in Las Vegas, titled Eddie Leon Missing Masterpieces. And there's a catalog that goes with that exhibition by the renowned Dave Hickey that some of you may be familiar with as well. In public collections, the list is long, but I'll just mention a few. She has obviously a piece in the American Airlines collection, and also the very impressive Frito-Lay's art collection, and then she also has work in this museum's collection. Linda is currently working on a new series of Christopher Columbus paintings, which I find very interesting, and I'm anxious to get to see personally. So with that, I'll turn it over to Linda, and she's going to take us through Andy Warhol, talk about it from her perspective as an artist.
Thank you. I'm thinking that we'll spend some time talking in that back room where the Last Supper is, because it's a comfortable room and people can sit on the floor or whatever, until I can just kind of give you a kind of basis of some thoughts that I have about Andy. But in the meantime, as we walk through, we might just walk past that big green Andy Warhol head that's in the collection of the modern, and then, and maybe you've all seen this, and if you have, you don't need to, the Campbell Soup prints that are in the back foyer there. And then past the gun, which is one of my very favorites, and then into the Last Supper room. So let's just kind of make a quick move back there, and then you all can make yourselves comfortable. For those of you who've not been here to see the Andy Warhol show, this particular show has its emphasis on the last 10 years of Andy Warhol's life and his production during that period. As you may know that in 1962 to 1968 was the period where he was the most prodigious, known for these particular pieces that have silkscreen imagery in them. But the pieces that I like the most are this particular piece and the gun piece, the Campbell Soup, and the big head of self-portrait that's green that's owned by the modern. And I feel like those are, to me, the best, the ones that I can refer to, I can feel the most comfortable with. And probably I feel like those are the most timeless ones. Now, the ones that are in this room, are done the last within the last 2 years of his life. And you kind of need to know, let me just say that a really, really good piece of art to me is has a kind of timeless quality to it. And no matter whether it was done in 1490 or if you think about, say, the great Velazquez that's over at the Kimball Museum, the man dressed in black that's a full standing man with a little red insignia, or the Duccio, which is just a little bitty altarpiece, or the little Fra Angelico. They all good art through the history of time has had certain qualities that make it timeless and make it have a structure that has a certain tension to it that makes you want to look at it over and over again. Sometimes you probably have seen works of art either that you own or somebody else owns that you cannot stand to look at. And one of the reasons probably is because it's either untrue or it is sentimental or some qualities that you don't like, false in some way. But really, really good art has a truth to it, and that is inherent, and it's inherent in both the structure of the composition and the outside of the way it works with the frame. The depth of it, the width of it, the size of it, the relationship of the surface and the tension in the composition, and the spiritual qualities that the artist puts in. It causes a certain kind of tension that makes it, you want to look at it over and over again. And I think you just sense that truth there. You sense that timelessness there. And everybody does. Everybody senses it. So it's there just for you to look at. Basically, I think I'll just tell you very briefly about how Andy Warhol came to this, because it sort of explains his sense of aesthetic, and it explains why it was so important in the art world when it came around. He was born in 1930 and was from a poor family of Czechoslovakian immigrants. His father was a coal miner, and he worked being a teenager, he worked at a department store window dressing, and he was always looking for ideas for windows. And this is somebody who's 15 years old, and he finds himself in this very small town working in a window dressing in a department store, and he looks through these Vogue magazines, and he's really taken with commercial art and decides that he wants to be a commercial artist. He goes to school, a technical college, Carnegie Institute, I believe the name of it is, a technical school, where he learns commercial art and has the great fortune that in this particular school, there's a lot of Bauhaus-derived designs that come that are being taught in this commercial art school, which was quite fortunate for him. And then when he was 19, he and Philip Perlstein, who is a friend, the artist Philip Perlstein, they both had like about $200. They moved to New York, and he was very influenced in the Bauhaus by Paul Klee. And as soon as you know or think about Paul Klee's work, you realize that he had a tremendous influence on Andy Warhol. And one of the reasons he did is because Paul Klee was a very linear artist and a very flat patterned artist too, which is, you can see that Andy Warhol has those same qualities in his work. One of the things they taught him, or he either invented himself or something that Paul Klee invented, was that you could take an ink pen or stick or whatever and mark with ink on a shiny, non-absorbent piece of paper and then blot it with an absorbent piece of paper, and all the drips and globs and blobs that are in that absorbed piece of paper come out on the absorbent one, and you throw away the original. But you have this, and if you just think about Paul Klee's drawings, they have that same linear quality. And you can see that he used that, and that in turn evolved into silkscreen lines. And these silkscreen lines have a little of that same quality when you look at them. Anyway, just briefly, he did very well in New York as a commercial artist, and he had that very sensitive touch and a beautiful drawing style that was very sensitive and very unique. And so he actually was a commercial artist there for about 10 years, and then during that period, he became enamored and decided he wanted to become a real artist, and was quite taken with Jackson Pollock, who came on the scene about that time. And I can remember the Life magazine where Jackson Pollock was on the cover, and it said, "Is this the greatest painter in the world?" And it had a big Jackson Pollock. And you can see that Warhol would be taken with that because it was linear, and he liked linear things. But of course, Pollock was very macho and was completely the opposite of Warhol, who was very tender and quiet and a gentle soul, or quiet anyway. I don't know how gentle he was, but anyway, quiet. So on the scene at that time was Rauschenberg and de Kooning, Klein, Motherwell, but no one was doing anything. Well, Lichtenstein sort of, I think he saw in the Castelli Gallery, he saw a Lichtenstein drawing of a girl with a beach ball, and he said, "Oh, I'm doing something like that in my home." He had been doing these very sensitive drawings, and the galleries, he'd shown in some galleries, but they were not too interested in his things. But he also, since he was a commercial artist, he was adept at showing the merch, which means if photographers say, "I want to do the merch," and that means do the whatever it is you're selling, point blank, straight on, and no background, just straight and simple. And so he actually got attracted to doing that because that's what he did. I mean, and so he just was able to begin to incorporate. He did a big Dick Tracy painting and had showed it to some people that were in the art world. Henry Gelsinger was a good friend of his. And Henry Gelsinger encouraged him to do that very direct, simple, straight-on imagery. And no one had really done that kind of flat space before. So it was a great jolt in the art world of just a plain image on a ground with no frills, no runny paint, no nothing. And the Campbell soup is probably a good example of that straightforward print, which is what he liked to do. He had this amazing sense of space, flatness, and the shapes around the space. And you can see that in this painting, and particularly in that gun painting. and just extremely sensitive to flatness, ground, space, design, and somehow the objects don't really matter too much. Oh, they do, but they don't. And that's always the way it is in art that is very good. The objects are important, but they are not the most important thing. You have the most important thing is the totality, all of those qualities, the qualities of the spirit of the artist, the way they did it. If you think about, for example, if you think about a Cézanne landscape or a Cézanne still life, and you see buildings off in the distance, and the buildings, it has deep space, but it is shallow in that it is saying, I'm still painting flat on the canvas because I have big paint strokes, sloshy paint strokes a little bit, and rooftops are kind of flat and square. So they stay sort of flat. And that sort of flatness and that little bit of painterly quality is saying, I am not an illusion of a landscape. I am a painting, and I am a painting on canvas, and therefore I have an integrity of my own. And what that really means is it says I'm an idea. And once you say that this is an idea, it gives you food for thought. It gives you all kinds of philosophical levels that you can address this with. And I think I can show it to you in this one. This, of course, you probably know. This was done right before he died. In fact, all of these were right around that same period. But in this one, he's hearkening back to his original style. and you probably know this about the Last Supper, that it was done in 1490, and it was done with oil paints instead of fresco, so therefore it began to deteriorate almost immediately. And then during the Second World War, that church was bombed, and so therefore it became like a freestanding wall standing out in the snow. And I think some American soldiers and military people covered it with a tarp during that period so that it would not be totally destroyed. And so it just has this history, a tremendous history behind it, of being one of the great pieces of art of the entire European civilization. And there was a gallery across the street in Milan who actually wanted to advertise the fact that they were across the street from the Last Supper. So they asked some artists to do the Last Supper, and this was his rendition. He's done several, but this is one that I feel like is great. Number one, someone said, I think it's Carter Radcliffe, said that to repeat something is to empty it. And if you look back there at those Christ wall pieces back there, they have emptied any of the subject matter that was there originally. So Warhol knew that the space around something, in fact, he said sometimes that the space around something was more interesting than the thing itself. And so it's an abstract, he's working always in abstraction. And when you repeat something, the more you repeat it, the less it means. And in that case of those back there, you begin to see it like you see a compartment, you see a quilt, you see a design of something else you no longer see, and they almost look like postage stamps rather than pictures of linear drawings. And the fact that it's a black ground with a yellow on top makes it even stranger, because it's like I'm taking away the total and complete meaning of this thing, which is what he does a lot. He's done that in these pieces that are behind us. It's kind of like saying, I'm putting it out and I'm taking it away. So you are left with having to deal with that, you know, with the idea. Of course, those being some of the last pieces he did, they have a postmodern kind of space, which is pretty... you could say that several people like David Sally, it means that you're drawing on top of a ground that you already have something on top of. And so it's two layers instead of one, in that case, of those pieces anyway. But going back to this one, can you hear me when I turn like this? Okay. Doubling this did not, to me, did not eliminate the meaning of it. In fact, in this case, it emphasizes the grandness of the piece, and he's abstracted it. When you look at that little chromolith that it comes from, it doesn't have a lot of, it doesn't look like this quite. This tablecloth that is just a whole yellow spread acts as this tremendous abstract anchor, and it just holds everything in place for that people swaying this way and people swaying that way in a kind of lyrical way. It's pretty interesting that the Jesus is centered by that arc right here, and a sense of this man's finger going up and around, and there's this gap right through here so that he remained separate from everybody. And that was probably one of Leonardo's main ideas, is to keep him separate. And of course that drape goes around like this. One night when I was trying to sleep, I was thinking about that big piece of yellow going across there, and I was thinking, you know what? I don't think they were eating any food. And then I looked, I had to go get the book out and look to see, yes, they were eating food, but that has been the tablecloth has been abstracted. And, you know, in Renaissance paintings, they all had a one-point perspective where your eye is drawn by the converging of the ceiling, the converging of the wall, the floor, and everything goes back to Christ's head. And that was a technique to really, they use that in churches, in architecture, to pull you into seeing what they want you to see. And although that is there, there's also some amazing things that he did. Like in that photograph, the walls are not the same. And he purposely bleached out that area in there on both sides. They're not quite the same. One of them is a little bit lighter than the other. But he also put these, you don't know whether these are the marks of the screen, but it's divided 8 panels across there. And that vertical kind of holds the strength. It's kind of like a Mondrian. The verticals hold the tablecloth this way, and they sort of make a place for all of this other activity to go on with the faces and the drama of the figures. And the designs on the walls are not there. I think they may exist in the, there was an encyclopedia drawing that somebody did, ink drawing of the Last Supper, that was really awful. And he used that for some of the images on the Christ in the back room and on those paintings. They come from a drawing, from encyclopedic drawing rather than from the painting. It's interesting that the bottom of the, this whole bottom piece is just made up. It doesn't hardly exist in that image. And there are no feet. I mean, there's what, 1 foot, 2 feet? Christ doesn't have any feet. And actually that whole bottom section looks a little bit like the shadow paintings that are in the front room. It's just totally abstract. I think that fact that he made that yellow, or a, whatever color that, doesn't look like a pure lemon yellow. It looks like it probably has, is toned down a little bit with some black or something, really gives you a sense of Renaissance painting and gives it a certain importance. Now, I can't imagine, he did do one that was pink. Now, for some reason, I don't think I can quite get with the pink one, but the flatness of the yellow one seems to work very well as being like a very solid, traditional yet abstract. And in a sense, the fact that you see that silk screen flattens that whole thing out. The texture of the silk screen that you can see there makes it, you're very aware that it's a silk screen illusion and not a real photographic illusion. So that keeps it kind of flat, and it keeps it in perfect proportion with the... Now, if he were to make this Last Supper 2 feet by 1 feet, you wouldn't have much, would you? The fact that he made it that scale gives it a sort of grandeur, but not too big. I mean, it's not, you know, if this were on the side of a building, it would make it a whole other idea. So I think that's what I get from that. Anybody have any questions about this piece? Could we go in and look at the gun piece?
He's in all the other, like, Andy Warhol and Gene...
Basquiat?
Yeah, who is he?
He has done some collaborations with him on this wall right here.
Okay.
We'll go in there and talk about him in just a second.
Great, thank you.
Is it acrylic and
printed on canvas?
The silk screen and acrylic.
So, do you think that has to do more with the texture of the canvas or the scale, logistically?
You mean the fact that it's a print, you mean?
Right, as opposed to printing on paper.
Well, it's really a painting, because even though he used a silk screen, it's on a three-dimensional, you know, it's not on paper, so you couldn't call it a print, really. You'd have to call it a painting. Because it's on a canvas. Yeah, yeah, I think so, yeah. That's an interesting question, though. Yeah. Is he ready? Someone just asked a question, which is kind of an interesting question, and that was, because that is a silk screen on the Last Supper, does that make it a print? and it it's a print, but it's not really a print, it's a painting. And you could say it's a three-dimensional paint on canvas. So, you know, it is a silk screen, but you wouldn't call it a print. Is a minor piece of art, usually on paper. And even though it's printed, it's not really a print, if that makes any sense. This is another one that I like a lot. And I think it's interesting that in this case, you know, I was talking about the Paul Klee doing multiple images and multiple lines, repeating and repeating. And in this case, the register of the silk screen is a double thing, but there's also an interesting ground where he has this silver under there that has a vertical repeating, which actually gives the painting a certain kind of energy that it's printed on. And it is an amazing abstract shape. It's almost like the gun. It's a gun, but it's not. It's a gun, but it's an image of a gun is more what it is rather than a replica of a gun. And he's abstracted it by eliminating the handle. And if that had a black handle, it would be so realistic that it would lose some quality of it. And the fact that it has a short barrel you don't associate that with a gun. You usually associate having a longer barrel. I mean, it's still a gun, but the fact that it is crammed in there very close to the very top and the sides, it gives it a tremendous kind of intensity on one hand, but on the other hand, it's abstract. It's just, it's like form and shape. So it has that dual meaning. And I think, you know, I think he had that kind of impersonal quality where he liked to see something as nothing a lot. And so therefore, it didn't matter whether he was doing a lemon or a whatever it was, wasn't that important. Even though this happens to be a later piece, I think. On the camouflage paintings, I think, to me, the works that he worked with Jean Michel Basquiat and the works that he did with the camouflage and the circles that he did back in the back room are not ever quite as good as the ones with the silkscreen images, because this is the idea of camouflage, and it has a kind of postmodern quality about it, because it's on a field, but it is a field, and it's camouflage, but it's not. And he kind of likes that play that it is, but it isn't anything. And I think one of the funny things is that he used to always be interested in camouflage, because he was always camouflaging himself to not be noticed going down the street, and he would always buy wigs and hats and whatnot to keep himself. So I think it was kind of an in-house joke with himself to do camouflage and then do it so that it's not camouflage. It's like an abstract painting, but it's a bad abstract painting. And I think that, you know, to maybe he didn't mind about that. Maybe that was all part of that. And this one has this underlying screen and silver quality and those horizontal lines and grid. And, you know, I don't know. I don't seem to relate to those. Does anybody really like these? I'd be curious to know. Well, if this is camouflage, I guess what I would say bad abstract painting is something that sometimes it becomes intangible. It hurts your eyes, and you say, this hurts my eyes, and it's because I don't see an anchor. Even if it's a flat ground or a poured painting, it has a sense of top and bottom and sides. And in this case, the fact that it's square almost cancels it out. I mean, it's the camouflage that's in there is a long panel. And somehow you can accept that, because a long panel usually means a narrative, or it means a mural, or it means something you're reading from one end to the end to another. And in these being almost square, they almost exist like a icon or like a thing. And the fact that they're flat, but you're not quite sure. I mean, space, going back, I mean, probably most of you know this, that light colors and bright colors come forward and darks recede visually. But in this case, in this particular piece, you've got those white lines that circle around the blue, so they don't go one way or another, and it just kind of hurts you. Mainly, I'm thinking it's the size of the piece. Now, you know, even if you made that very small, it might work better than that size. It's kind of an outrageous thing to do, make it that size and make it that ugly. Now, I think about what I get from Andy Warhol. When I was in school and the in Berkeley at the university, doing graduate school, Rauschenberg and Lichtenstein were kind of my favorites. I couldn't quite get on to Warhol at that time, but I can certainly see that his sense of space, he kind of freed artists to use any kind of space they want. And that, but you know, when you think about it, he could do that because he came from commercial art. He was a graphic designer. Things never went back in space in the way that I was taught as a painter. As a painter, you learn deep space, you learn how to control colors forward, backward, and you learn a little bit about the picture front plane. But you see, Warhol didn't have that background, so he used just that flat color and line primarily to define and make all of his works. And so that gave him an edge over everybody else who was doing it at the same time. I mean, Rosenquist did the long murals of spaghetti and rocket ships and whatever, planes, B-36 planes, and they were like long murals, and they were kind of realism abstracted because they were so big and so clumped together. So they had their place. But nobody had ever done the kind of plain, old, flat, you know, here's the thing, and that's it, and I don't care, kind of a little bit of that kind of quality to it that he had. Do you want to go in and look at this other camouflage painting? Hi. You know, Andy Warhol, maybe I didn't mention this, but you know, he got shot in 1968, and then he also said he was going to quit painting somewhere around 1965. So he's really only working on the silkscreen images for just a few years. And he also had all those famous people portraits that he did, Liz Taylor, Marilyn Monroe, and all of those. I personally don't like those quite as much because they, even though they are intriguing from a design point of view, I don't feel like they have a kind of lasting power because they are a personality in a way, and they don't have the kind of qualities that he put into, say, for example, the gun or the Last Supper. They seem to me to be like commissions in a way, and they don't seem quite as vital. However, I have to admire the fact that after 10 years, and he went back to painting, and he did this body of work, it's almost like he's begun again to struggle and to find a way. And he's still not finding it with paint and three-dimensional like a normal painter does, but he's trying it with lots of these other different ways, and one of them would be, you know, like the yarn painting here that was a commission from a yarn company in Germany or somewhere. And I'm not real crazy about these. That one I like a little better than these two because these seem to me to be go with those two back there. They have that same kind of quality. They're just annoying to me about you know. I can take this camouflage a little bit better because it's like a field painting to me. And you know it's camouflage, and yet it has, for some reason, that green jumps forward to you, and you can think of it as somehow relating to outdoor or outdoor tarps or something that has to do. So there's something about that one that I feel like works a little bit better. And part of it is the scale, too. The fact that you may chose to make it that big seems to give it more power than with the square ones, which become more icons. The Rorschach one back here, you probably know that he did a lot of silver and gold stuff. He used a lot of silver and gold paint. And he just did this line drawing on one side and then folded the canvas over. So it's kind of back to Paul Klee again, the idea of making a duplicate or making an ink block by folding something over. And I like that one better than this one in here, because it's remaining an abstract painting, and it's kind of in between. You know, it has a certain amount of depth. It stays flat just a little bit, and it has a sort of mystery to it, and relating to human body and organic stuff in a way. And I think to me that proportions of that work very well, the size of it and the scale of it. I'm not real crazy about the oxidation paintings. They seem like they're just kind of, I mean, you probably know this story that Jackson Pollock peed on paintings sometimes when he was going to sell them to somebody he didn't like. And there's also been sort of a tradition of that goes back in art history. So I think this was Andy Warhol's oxidation period, where he would have someone come in and one of his assistants come in and urinate on these metallic paint, which turned it green. And, you know, it's kind of like saying, it's kind of a snub nose saying, you know, I can do anything. And, I mean, there was that talk around the art world that Leo Castelli could sell anything. You know, it didn't matter what it was, that... You know, and in a way, it's kind of a, they're nice, they have composition, you can see them as being somewhat interesting, but, you know, that is what they are, so you take it or leave it, whatever suits you. They're not my favorites because I don't feel like they have the same substance. They don't have the same substance as the others in there. You want to go back in and look at real quick at the joint ones, the ones he did. And I believe it's just these two that are collaborations with other artists. And this is, what is his name? Francesco Clemente and Jean Michael Basquet and Andy Warhol doing, all three working on this same canvas. And this was the idea of the Milan art dealer, to have a collaboration. But to my way of thinking, the collaboration, it still looks like a collaboration when you get through with it. It looks like you're having three people work on something and nobody making the complete control over everything. Even though the white on top seems to tie it together, it just would become a matter of personal taste as to whether or not you felt like that was, I mean, it looks complete on one hand, but I don't think it's classic or great compared to some of his other pieces. And this one looks like a totally Andy Warhol, but you can really admire him because of this collaboration with Jean Michael, who did very direct, very childlike, very straight on, flat drawing and painting. And he influenced Warhol to go back into painting and make, get back into doing something that's very startling and something that's very out on the edge. And so I think this, here you'll still see the commercial artist in Andy Warhol, and he's starting with that kind of postmodernist space of putting one thing on top of another. And that one feels pretty good to me. I feel like I kind of like a little of the tension that's implied in that one. I don't really like the collaboration over here of Jean Michael that much. It feels like it kind of feels like that one. It's like searching out for something but not quite getting there to make a complete whole. It still looks like it's fragmentary and not having a... I guess I tend to like things that get very tight and very classic, because that's what I'm interested in my own art. My own art has layers and layers of stuff that you find underneath paint, and then I also add kind of illustrative things on top, and you kind of find things in the paint, and then you add other things that on top and around, but I like for it to have a very tight order when you get through, a solid, you know, that not one thing can be put to it or one thing taken away from it. So it has a kind of classical order. Now, some other people might not feel that way, and they might like this the best because it has a kind of raunchy, you know, I'm going out and just make you, you know, you'll have to deal with this by you're in your own terms, whoever's seeing this. That little face, the green face, is what Jean Michael used to do a lot, and he was known as Sammo himself. He called himself Sammo. He worked at Peregrin Press when I did in the 80s. In fact, he was there right before he died. And I didn't meet him because each person who comes in has the press to themselves. And he would want to work at 2 in the morning and have everybody get up and come in there and work with him. And I think he was doing drugs then. And I think he died of an overdose shortly thereafter. So... He's been around here, so. How about going back in and looking at the museum's Andy Warhol, and then we'll kind of split, okay? The museum's Andy Warhol, I really think is a great painting, and it has this wonderful kind of mop texture on the bottom of it, where he took a big mop and gave it some, you can probably see the mop marks under it, and that gave it some quality of dimension for the flatness of the image. He has on one of his famous wigs, but it also looks like he then in turn painted more strings of hair up at the top. Those are painted on. They don't look like they're part of the silk screen. A sort of giving himself a little stature there with his hair. And that seems like another one of those paintings that's very classic, because he's very aware of the space and the power of a single image being pushed and pressured up to the top. So you feel this tremendous force in that face. And it looks to me like maybe he simplified the eyes and the mouth with just black paint to give you that sort of dramatic. And you know that this is probably not his hair down here at the bottom. But none of it matters because it has that force. And then also the force of the screen from the bottom to the top. You see that green that comes up? You have a sense of a force and then a focused vision right there in the middle at you. So it's very intriguing. And I feel like it's very classic. And the museum was very wise to get that painting because it's really a good one. This one you probably know is The Shadow from the Shadow series. And they've been said that they're very phallic images. And, you know, he was a homosexual. And he used to go out early on and go to disco. And he referred to this as disco designs. He has some of these panels that go in some places all the way around the room in different colors. And actually, you know, they have a nice quality to them. Again, it's that sense of a print and the fact that these, you know, they wouldn't be nearly as good if they didn't have these white edges here because they have those edges define each panel. And again, it's that sense of scale and size and the texture that's underneath that gives them that visual power. And again, it's that thing of saying, I like nothing, you know, I like... He once said, what did he say? He said somebody was interviewing him and he said, I wish they'd just tell me what to say and I'll say it. Because he never had that much to say about his art. And he really wanted to have it come from it from almost an impersonal nature. But I think those are good. I don't think they're quite on the level of these others. But does anybody have any questions? Anybody?
Where's the Marilyn? Big Marilyn. We'll let you know. So
downstairs, yeah.
Downstairs?
Uh-huh. That's really one of the better Marilyns. Then there's a silver, four Marilyns out there, and then there's the silver Mona Lisas out here. Which, you know, the Mona Lisas is really nice because it's kind of like saying I'm giving you the Mona Lisa and then I'm taking it away. So all you get is this little tiny piece of it, which is really nice. Anybody else have any questions? Well, thanks. Thanks very much for coming. It was very nice.